Good evening. You're listening to WNUR 89.3 FM HD1 Evanston, Chicago. I'm Juliet Allen, and this is WNUR News at 6. Tonight, a former ambassador turned NU professor shares insight on the fight for democracy, a peek into the new play, La Ventanita, musings with a jazz musician, and an episode of Well-Versed honoring AAPI Heritage Month. Those stories and more coming up from Northwestern University. This is WNUR News at 6. More than 200 former U.S. ambassadors, diplomats, and national security leaders signed an open letter warning that American democracy is under threat thanks to President Donald Trump. Among the signatories is a former ambassador who now teaches at Northwestern. WNUR News' Micah Sandy has the story.
A group of more than 200 former ambassadors, national security officials, and senior diplomats has recently signed an open letter titled, The Assault on American Democracy, A Call to Action. Many of these individuals are retired but hold decades of experience. In the letter, they warn of, quote, grave danger. The letter states, quote, the challenge comes from within as President Trump and his administration have assaulted the pillars of our democracy here at home and our strength around the world. Throughout this letter, the former public servants condemn what they describe as the dismantling of democratic norms under President Trump. They also call out attacks on free speech and the judiciary, as well as the corrosion of U.S. alliances and global credibility. The signatories urge institutions and leaders on both sides of the aisle to take respective actions to preserve democracy. They call on the general public to, quote, speak out and mobilize. Here at Northwestern, one of the letter's signatories is Ambassador-in-Residence Ian Kelly, a retired Foreign Service officer who last served as the U.S. Ambassador to Georgia under the Obama administration. He now teaches at Northwestern under the International Studies program. I sat down with him to talk about why he signed the letter, what his biggest concerns are, and more. So first, thank you so much for being open to this interview. The first question, why did you decide to sign this letter, and was there a tipping point for you?
I think that we do have to, as the letter says, speak out about the erosion of the various institutions established by our Constitution. And of course, the overall effect of the first 3 months of the Trump presidency has been for the executive branch to gather more and more executive power towards itself, which, of course, is antithetical to the idea of our republic.
And how did your experience as an ambassador shape that decision?
I have been particularly concerned about the very dramatic, almost 180-degree turn in our attitude towards our alliances in particular. Normally, when you do things like fundamentally change the orientation of our foreign policy, you bring in Congress. It was completely ignored in this decision. And then there's the virtual elimination of a number of foreign policy agencies, most prominently USAID, but also other institutions that were established by Congress.
As you described just now, it's very different from any presidency currently right now. So to you and those who signed the letter, what's the significance of so many former diplomats and national security officers? I counted 203, unless I'm mistaken. Is there any previous open letter similar to this one that came before?
There have been these kinds of letters, and I've signed a few of them when it came to specific foreign policy issues. This is a bit different. I mean, this is about not an external threat. This is about turning the United States, through a lack of a political process, turning the United States into a different country, basically. And so we wanted to point out how turning us into a different country has national security implications. One is, of course, the growing lack of trust in our reliability by our allies, the kind of signals that we're sending to predatory powers. Not saying that we've turned into an authoritarian regime, but as the letter says, we have to speak out about these tendencies or we will lose what we once had.
And along with the call for action, the letter describes a grave danger to America's moral foundation and calls Trump's actions authoritarian. So why do you think this language is important for your readers and for anyone else?
The American people have to pay attention to what the consequences can be. Intimidating judges, real bedrock of our of our constitutional republic is an independent judiciary. And by intimidating, even arresting judges, you are undermining that co-equal branch of government. If this continues, we will not have a republic.
And right now we live in a time of heavy polarization in the United States. Do you think this letter and any similar actions that come from it or associated with it that may arise will get through to those who still side with President Trump and who might call it alarmist or reduce its two-partisan rhetoric?
I'm hoping that as time goes by, there will be more voices speaking up. I don't know if there's going to be a tipping point. I suspect that it will come as the president's approval numbers go down. They really won't go down until people see a direct effect on them. And that would be mostly economic, I think. I think that this tariff war that we've embarked on could be that tipping point.
Circling back to Northwestern, to education, since that was another important facet of the letter, not specifically Northwestern, but education and educational institutions. What relevance do you think this letter and its warnings have for students here at this time, taking into account the current situation with research, federal funding, and the sharp 180 we just saw with how student visas were revoked but then given back?
That is an example of how speaking out can have an impact. I mean, there was, I think, quite a bit of pushback from universities and from voters when it comes to going after international students in particular, for no other reason than exercising their First Amendment rights. I think that there's going to be a big battle over federal money for university. I'm hoping that it doesn't lead to real harm to universities, which would be cutting off or greatly diminishing funding of federal research across the board, or taking away universities' tax-free status. Those would be very, very destructive. And I can't imagine that Congress would do it. But it is important to write your representatives.
Another aspect of being a professor is students likely come to you with concerns, or they seek guidance that goes beyond the classroom. And have those conversations changed since President Trump returned?
People questioning whether the Foreign Service will continue as a body of nonpartisan experts and professionals. And I have to be honest with them. Another thing that is unprecedented about this administration is normally about 50 to 70% of the ambassadorial nominations are for career officers. So far this year, Donald Trump has nominated or confirmation in the Senate, 51 ambassadors. There are zero career officers who are then named as ambassadors. And this is where, again, the Senate has to do something about this.
And then turn it to the future. Critics from any side may argue that letters like these don't change much. What would success look like for you and the other signatories of this letter?
I've sent at least one message per week to my elected representatives, pointing out how, you know, Congress needs to have a say in these radical changes in our security orientation toward the world and toward foreign policy. But when you have hundreds of former senior national security officials, you do get some traction in the media. And the whole point of this is keep speaking out. One person can't change the world, but millions of people can.
And on that similar note, if there's one message from this letter that you'd want every American to hear, but especially young people, such as the students you teach, what would it be?
Unless we stand up and protest any kind of erosion of those principles, we're going to lose what we had. Most people have heard the famous quote of Ben Franklin coming out of the Constitutional Convention. He asked him as he was coming out, "What did you accomplish here? What did you create here?" And he said, "A republic, if you can keep it." So even back in 1787, the founders recognized that this is a fragile thing that we've created, this idea of separation of powers and the importance of due process. These are the kind of rights that we have that can be easily taken away. And that's why this letter says we need to stand up and speak out.
Be sure to check out WNURnews.org for a fuller version of this interview. For WNUR News, I'm Micah Sandy.
A new play written and directed by a Northwestern sophomore is bringing Cuban culture, Miami coffee, and student voices to the stage. Ella Barnes has more on La Ventanita.
In Shanley Pavilion, a new student production is brewing.
Well, my play is called La Ventanita, which means The Little Window.
That's director and playwright, sophomore Lux Vargas.
And I started writing it in my intro to playwriting class, winter of my freshman year, when it was really cold here and I was really missing home, which for me is Miami, Florida. And so I kind of started writing my play about just this young girl who was like moving away for college and spent her last summer in Miami working at a Ventanita. And it kind of evolved into being really Cuban, which I'm really Cuban, so that's a good thing, I think. And it's kind of a story of like Miami and Cubans, and also of like the Patria y Vida movement, which is like the Cuban movement for liberation. So, yeah.
What started as a 30-page class project evolved quickly. Lux submitted her script to the Vibrant Colors Collective, also known as VC Squared, which selected it as their spring artist-in-residence production. That's when the production team started to form.
They kind of asked if I was thinking of having someone else direct it, but I really love directing. So then I asked if I could direct it, and they said yes, which is really kind, because that's not a thing that happens a lot in Stucco, so I feel very lucky.
Yumi Talud is the producer for La Ventanita, and she says taking on the role has been a surprisingly good time.
Honestly, like, everything I've heard about producing has been, like, a horror story. Everybody's always like, I'm never producing again. Like, that was the most stressful thing I've ever done. Like, blah, 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 blah. And I realized, I was like, it's just a bunch of, like, sending emails. And I was like, wait, awesome. So it's been really fun. I'm a GCal warrior, so, like, all I do is, like, send out my GCal invites and send my emails and, like, make my appointments. And, like, that's all producing is, really.
Junior sound designer Paris Bazzuti has more experience under her belt, but she said she's just as excited about the play.
So I'm actually on VC Squared, which is the board producing it. And once we, you know, once the show was pitched to us and selected, I was really excited. And I think I texted Lux like 2 weeks after and was like, hey, if you need a sound designer, I want a sound design. And that's how she said yes. And so I've been working on it ever since.
Yeah.
Sound design wise, there's so much music that's going to be really fantastic. We have Latin music ensemble, so it's going to be really fun to mix them. Cues-wise, there's a lot of, like, cool soundscapes. We go from Miami to Cuba, and there's, like, a lot of interesting locations. And, yeah, I think it's just a really unique play.
For some cast members, La Ventanita is more than just a play. It's personal.
I'm Adrian Ayala Perez.
And I'm Rogelio Munoz Franco.
Both cast members grew up in Miami, and that's part of what drew them to the show.
So my sophomore year, I was hanging out with Lux, who was a freshman at the time, and she mentioned that she had this idea for a play. We're both from Miami, and I got super excited. And when she had everything ready to go for auditions, I was like, I have to be there.
I actually never auditioned for the play. I had a different circumstance, but I was there for the original reading of the play, and I'm also from Miami. But then someone in the play who was playing Valentin originally ended up dropping, so Lux called me and asked if I was still interested, and I said yes immediately because I thought this play was an amazing play.
Learning lines, blocking, and choreography was a steep learning curve, especially since it's both of their first times in a show. Adrian shared more.
This is my first time in theater, so I've never seen the production side of it, so it's been very exciting and at the same time very nerve-wracking because you're like just doing things you've never been used to doing. But I've had a lot of support with the production team and my cast members. It's been great.
The team started loading a week early, a rare luxury in Shanley, and Yumi shared that they used that time to build and adjust to the space.
But yeah, we have a lot of like non-theater majors on the team as well, which was also great for the extra time because we had a little bit more time for people to get like situated and figure out what was going on. People in the cast who aren't theater had more time to get familiar with Shanley and sort of like spend that time like in the space before starting to like do Q2Q.
Now well into Tech Week, the cast and crew are excited to show off their hard work this weekend.
Come to La Ventanita Friday 7 p.m., 10 p.m., Saturday 2 p.m., 7 p.m.
Exactly what he said.
For WNUR News, I'm Ella Barnes.
What does it mean to be a musician, and why do people pursue it? John Kowalski has some perspectives.
What does it mean to be a musician? On Tuesday, April 22nd, 2025, Reggie Thomas played with the Northwestern University Jazz Orchestra. Ever since he was a child, Thomas knew he wanted to work with music.
I've always known my entire life that I was a musician. Even before I knew anything about music, I knew I was a musician and that's what I was going to do.
Thomas's love for music transcended all boundaries, including sleep.
So I was kind of, I started in the school, but then I just loved it. So I looked for the music wherever I could. And there was a radio station down in the St. Louis area with a guy by the name of Leo Cheers, the man in the red vest. And he would play music from midnight until 6 a.m. So I went to school pretty groggy a lot of times because I was trying to stay up all night listening to the music.
Music is universal in the human experience. Derek Gardner, the director of jazz studies at Northwestern, has known Thomas for many years and, similarly, has worked with music for much of his life. When asked about his first gig, Gardner said this.
I was about maybe 18 or 19, I think. And then that was just like a little hole in the wall gig, you know, but it was with some real cats, you know. But my first real professional gig, oh my goodness, was with Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey Circus. And I wasn't ready. I was not ready. And the rehearsals were like, it was true professional band. They're like, okay, let's do this rehearsal. Okay, let's do the Foxtrot, page number 3. Okay, you go. Okay, next. Okay, let's go to page 49 and do this. Okay, the waltz. Okay, that's it. And then that was it. And then it was the gig. And then the elephants came out. And you had to take this big breath. Like, oh. You know, I was like, what the hell? And I folded, man. I was, you know. So, but it was a wake-up call. I said, you know, okay, now I know what this feels like. You know, that water was really cold. I got to get used to the water, you know.
Thomas and Gardner put themselves through hours of practice and hardship for music. But what does it feel like to solo? Ethan Kasparian Wiseman, a first-year student at Northwestern, spoke to me about the thoughts going through his head when he's up on stage.
For me, jazz is integrity. And at that point, like, when you're up there, when you're playing, when you're listening to everything that's around you, and everything that's around you is responding right back to you, it's a manifestation of the sense of self. So that's what I'm thinking about, I think. Like, who am I? What story do I want to tell? What kind of artist do I want to be? And what message do I want sort of the audience to come away with?
These are just a few perspectives on music. But at the end of the day, everybody needs to form their own relationship with this universal human experience.
I think that's the ultimate for anybody, to just find their own voice within jazz and within music itself.
For WNUR News, I'm John Kowalski.
The month of May marks the commemoration of Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. For this episode of Well-Versed, Basil Free brings us two poems to celebrate the literary achievements made by Asian Americans, Native Hawaiians, and Pacific Islander Americans.
Hello. Have you taken the time to connect with and celebrate your identity today? Welcome to Well-Versed, WNUR News' poetry segment where you hear timely readings to help you relax, reflect, and reconnect. The month of May marks the celebration of Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, recognizing the contributions of Asian Americans, Native Hawaiians, and Pacific Islander Americans to the history and culture of the United States. For this episode of Well-Versed, we'll be diving into two poems by Asian American and Native Hawaiian poets in commemoration. Suji Kwok Kim is a Korean-American-British poet and playwright. A former Fulbright scholar, she studied at Seoul National University and Yonsei University, where her great-grandfather had been a professor and co-founder of the Korean Language Society, organized in resistance to Japanese occupation. Her work has been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times. Here is Ricefield Road at Dusk by Suji Kwok Kim. After Ko-un. In the village, it's the season of dried grass, the smell of burned dirt, gaslight glinting through blackened stubble. I walk home across the rice fields, brushing insects away from my face, remembering old Nam Dong who was buried yesterday. What does death ask of us? I must change whatever it was I was when the old man was alive. I keep looking at the rice fields glinting in the dark. blasted by mildew, more withered than last year. How much work and love it must have taken. In autumn, no matter how bad the harvest, how big the debts, no thought of leaving here, no thought of rest. As life goes on, time isn't the largest thing to think of, it's the smallest. Growing, going in drought or monsoon, mold or blight, what is the rice if not alive? Nō'u Rovila is a queer Hawaiian femme poet. Her debut book, Ask the Brindled, won the 2021 National Poetry Series, and she currently serves as an assistant professor of creative writing at the University of Hawaii Manoa. Here is Threshold by Nō'u Rovila. After Sounding by Kathy Jutnil Kijener and Joy Enomoto. A mass stranding, I could not deliver the poem. The Navy determined that vessels involved in training and testing might strike and kill endangered blue whales. I can never find poetry in the Bible. A mass ready to be surveilled, ready to be measured like the sound of water crashing from our eyes. Poetry limited to islands, I could not deliver the poem. Instead, this threshold of baskets, this wall, door, something to swing open, I could not deliver a legacy of outstretched palms. In the Bible, sound waves measure the ocean floor. In the Navy, sound waves measure damage to land and reef systems. In the Pacific, where do you find faith? The poem pulls you deeper, deliver a chord hanging deeper, the poem so deep it is ghost blue and swims to the end of the poem, a chiefly death rhythms across the room, the Bible crashing inside the poem, waters the poem, deep blue waters I can never find, in authorized mortalities, deliver the poem, the brown in our blood, the native in our speech, another mat, basket, never find another stranded marine mammal. Poetry might strike poetry, might kill the no-action poem. The no-action poem dies here. Thank you for listening to Well Versed. For WNUR News, I'm Basil Free.
Now for a brief look at the forecast. Thursday and Friday highs will be in the mid-50, about 10 degrees cooler than today. But we'll get some warmth from the sun with 35% cloud cover on Thursday and only 10% on Friday. This trend will continue into the weekend with a breezy 65-degree high on Saturday. Next week should be even warmer with temps in the mid to high 70s. But I don't even care as long as it's nice for Dillo Day. Taking a look into headlines in Evanston, Chicagoland, and across the nation and globe. Black smoke drifted above the Sistine Chapel today. The Vatican conclave convened today to elect the new pope. The smoke signals that they have not yet reached a two-thirds majority, so they will reconvene tomorrow morning to continue deliberating. This weekend, U.S. and Chinese officials will meet to discuss trade. Today, Trump said that he would not lower tariffs on Chinese goods. The current minimum tariff on exports from China is 145%. Nightly streaming might look a little different next week. For the first time in 12 years, Netflix redesigned their homepage. The change will launch next week and will only apply to television screens. That's all for WNUR News at 6 p.m. For more news updates and reports, follow us on X at WNUR News and Instagram at WNUR News 893. You can listen to these and other WNUR News stories on our website, WNURnews.org. That's WNURnews.org. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Our producer today is Sophia Kesa, and our reporters are Micah Sandy, Ella Barnes, John Kowalski, and Basil Free. I'm Juliet Allen. Catch our next newscast Friday, May 9th. Now, back to scheduled programming.